Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about efforts to clean up contamination along the St. Louis River. The Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement between the U.S. and Canada listed the river in 1987 as one of 43 sites that are the most polluted on the Great Lakes. Those sites are known as areas of concern. This week, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced the river was one step closer to restoration. Fish tumors and deformities are no longer considered to be an impairment to the river. Matt Steiger is the St. Louis River Area of Concern Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. He spoke with me about the cleanup that's been ongoing and results of a study on fish tumors in the river.
The study that we undertook with partners with the EPA and USGS and West Virginia University. They've been studying fish tumors in the Great Lakes for many years, and they did three different sampling events, 2011, 2013, and 2015. And they sample white sucker, which is a fish that uses almost all of the habitats in the area of concern. It's a very diverse system, the lake, the wetlands, the riverine portions, and some developed portions, the slips and the channels. So the white sucker is known to be a benthic fish, and it was chosen as a good indicator of having the time spent in all these different habitats and also being in direct contact with sediments. That's why we chose white sucker.
Okay, so when you say benthic, you mean like bottom feeding.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, in contact with the sediments during a lot of the time. So the white sucker we sampled was 622 of them over the three study periods. Essentially, the results were very favorable. There was a low incidence rate of tumors in the population. I believe we were at 4.7%. tumor rate, which is a pretty regular rate for most areas, even if they don't have a history of pollution. The study really was a robust look at the incidence rate of the tumors in those fish, and we were comfortable using those data to support a BUI removal, and our targets had been met.
And when you say BUI removal, you mean removing that impairment, that fish tumor impairment from the St. Louis River?
Yeah, the official terminology for the impairments is beneficial use impairment, or BUI.
Okay. So why did we have fish tumors? Why were we seeing deformities, in fish like the white sucker? I mean, what kind of contamination are we seeing that's contributing to that, or was?
So the exact cause of tumors can be a whole spectrum of things. I mean, fish health and toxicology is a whole different field that I am not an expert in at all, but it's just like a human population. The age, sex, different environmental exposures can cause all kinds of deformities, and even parasites and other things, bacteria and things like that. But what they found, they did comparison of the rate for fish that had shown a higher percentage of their diet in the estuary versus out in the lake. And then they also compared fish above the Fond du Lac Dam within the St. Louis River as different reference populations. And there was no significant difference found in fish that got more of their diet in the estuary versus the lake or above the dam.
Okay. So why was the fish tumor or fish deformities, that impairment, why was that listed for the river in the first place?
The historic documents that I have, they indicate that, at the time of listing, it was a community effort. So they did take what data they had at the time and kind of list these impairments on a best guess, I guess, for lack of a better term. Some of the impairments had a lot more data than others. This one, there were a few sites that they had specifically identified as having some tumors or deformities observed. I think they had some anecdotal information from fishermen, but there was no specific study or a rate established within fish populations in our estuary. So I think to err on the side of caution, they were listing this impairment so that more study could be done, a better understanding could be achieved in the future. And that's how we removed the impairment, was to look at it in depth.
Because you found no difference from fish that were feeding in the estuary, in the St. Louis River estuary, to those feeding out in Lake Superior.
So there were fish on the whole spectrum of, because they migrate from the lake to the river depending on the time of year and I would assume food sources and things like that. So the fish themselves usually had a mix of everything, but some fish had a really high proportion of the lake or really high proportion of the river.
So originally there were 9 out of a 14 possible list of impairments that were listed on the St. Louis River. You've removed 2. So what work needs to be done yet to remove the other remaining 7 impairments? Like, and what are they?
So we have 7 remaining impairments: fish consumption advisories, degraded fish and wildlife habitat, degraded fish and wildlife populations, degraded benthic community, so bottom-dwelling organisms, restrictions on dredging, excessive loading of sediment and nutrients to the Lake Superior, and beach closings and body contact restrictions.
And so I guess maybe just taking a step back, what have you accomplished so far in the work on the river since it was listed as one of the sites in 1987, did you say?
Yeah. So the biggest step in the health of the river really was improved wastewater treatment. And that was done shortly after the Clean Water Act, I think in the late 70s and early 80s. So that really kickstarted the cleanup of the river once, I guess, waste in the river was just reduced. The health of the river was rebounding slowly. And at that time is when this Area of Concern program was developed to kind of move these areas out of the worst of the polluted areas to clean them up. So there has been a lot of progress in all those areas to date. It started with a lot of planning efforts. There wasn't a whole lot of funding available on the large scale that's needed to really clean up some of these major pollution sites until the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So as an example, some of the Superfund sites that were listed on the river, St. Louis River, Interlake, Duluth Tar was the first one to be remediated. That was in Minnesota, and a portion of that site's in Wisconsin, so that was a joint effort. The U.S. Steel site is the other Superfund site in the AOC. That one's underway, and that one's completely in Minnesota. The Hog Island Inlet and Newton Creek work was completed in 2007. Many different phases of cleanup along that creek and in the inlet. That was a Wisconsin site. We've done a number of habitat restorations along the river, and we're really in full implementation mode in the last couple of years using supporting funds from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to move a lot of these projects from being on a list to getting them done and getting them implemented out on the river.
And the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is that pool of federal funds that was started by President Barack Obama, or started under him, where around $300 million each year was devoted to cleanup projects like cleaning up these areas of concern. It sounds like that has really sped up your ability to clean up contamination in the river.
Yeah, so the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, if it's fully funded at its $300 million level, I believe it's like a third of that goes directly to the areas of concern. They have different focus areas within that funding, and I think areas of concern are the highest priority. Of the remaining AOCs on the Great Lakes, we all collaborate through EPA to get projects funded that are necessary to remove impairments within our AOCs. The GLRI, yeah, has been extremely important in helping to fund direct implementation projects on the ground in the areas of concern.
And as you're moving forward then, what are some of the projects that you're going to be working on the Wisconsin side of the river to move forward with cleaning up this particular hotspot or the area of concern?
The next few years are going to be some big years in the entire AOC for restoration and contamination cleanup. We, on the Wisconsin side, we have a number of projects that are in construction. under some of our habitat impairments, we have a fish passage barrier removal project. That one is happening within the watershed, the Nemadji River watershed, on Little Balsam Creek in the town of Summit. That one's underway, and we're working on phase one of that project, and it will continue in the summer of 2019.
So I'm sorry, what does that include, or what is that work aiming to do?
So under the loss of fish and wildlife habitat impairment, it was identified that barriers to fish movement are impairing their ability to access habitat. So under the Area of Concern program, we prioritized the removal of one system with barriers on it. So we conducted a culvert inventory across the AOC and prioritized Little Balsam Creek as the site that we would work on through the AOC program. Essentially, the structures that are on this creek were not allowing the native fish populations to get to the headwaters of the creek. And it is connected. Little Balsam Creek connects all the way out to the lake through the Nemadji River if it had no barriers on it. There's four crossings along Little Balsam Creek that we are essentially upgrading from undersized culverts to a better crossing with fish passage through that structure, accessing spawning areas or cold water refuge.
And the city of Superior and the Wisconsin DNR and EPA and U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are also moving forward on the project to clean up contamination in Howard's Bay. How significant is that project as part of the St. Louis River Area of Concern?
Yeah, Howard's Bay is another project that should be underway either late 2019 or early 2020. The partnerships were essential in getting that one moving, and along with the Great Lakes funding. That is the largest cleanup site on the Wisconsin side of the river. So getting that one going is very significant.
What are some of the other projects that you're going to be working on in the future?
Yeah, so another one that falls under the beach closings impairment is the Barker's Island beach restoration. That's another partnership with the City of Superior that we've been working on in 2018 and now will continue in 2019. We essentially did a complete redesign of that beach. It was closed too often due to high E. coli issues. So we partnered with the city as well as Douglas County Health, the Lake Superior Research Institute at UW-Superior to do a source tracking study of where the potential contamination was coming from and how we could solve those issues. So we've redesigned the beach and added some amenities to reduce trash and debris, reduce the attractive nature of that site to gulls and geese and ducks, also enhance some of the wetland areas. We're excited to see that one get finished in 2019 and stay open for more of the beach season.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought I saw that you have a target to finish up a cleanup on some of the contamination or all of the contamination in the St. Louis River Area of Concern by 2025. Is that your goal, and are you hopeful that you'll be able to meet that goal?
Yeah, so we are actually looking to get our management actions completed by the end of the federal fiscal year of 2024, with eventual BUI removals by 2025 to allow for some project wrap-up and writing the final reports and things like that. So it is an aggressive timeline. We have been shooting for 2025 for a number of years now, but we've got a plan and a strategy in place. And now that the funding seems to be continued for the last 9 years, I think if the funding continues at the same level it has, that we should be able to achieve that goal.
Again, you were just listening to Matt Steiger with the Wisconsin DNR about efforts to clean up the St. Louis River. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear more about the largest cleanup project on the Wisconsin side of the river from the US EPA's Chris Korleski and Scott Sanowski. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. In this hour, we're talking about efforts to clean up the St. Louis River, one of the most contaminated sites on the Great Lakes. Up next, we hear more about a project to clean up pollution in Superior's Howard's Bay. The project is expected to cost around $18.5 million, with work slated to begin sometime next year. Chris Korleski is the director of the Great Lakes National Program Office with the U.S. EPA, and Scott Sanowski is the section chief of Great Lakes Remediation and Restoration for the agency. They spoke with me by phone about efforts to clean up areas of concern on the Great Lakes, like the St. Louis River, and the largest cleanup effort on the Wisconsin side of the river.
In the sort of pre-EPA, pre-pollution control and prevention era, there was just a tremendous amount of waste materials being disposed of by various industries. And anyway, a lot of that material ended up in the places that we're trying to clean up today. To be an area of concern, you have to be impaired in a number of certain ways. And we have this really technical-sounding term called a beneficial use impairment. Or we call it a BUI. There are 14 of them. And they can include anything from, you know, the fish, you can't eat the fish, to you can't dredge the sediments because they're too contaminated and you'll stir all that up, to degraded habitat. Again, there are 14 impairments that we identify. And an AOC, an area of concern, is an AOC because it's been tagged with one or more of these impairments. So again, we started out in 1987 with 43 of these. I'm happy to say that, and I'll just speak to the U.S. side, I won't speak for the Canadians today, because of the GLRI, that's been a real fiscal shot in the arm, and it's given us the resources to really accelerate our work in cleaning up the AOCs. As I said, we started out with 31 U.S. AOCs, again, 12 on the Canadian side. Of those 31 AOCs, we've now delisted 4, which means they are totally off the list. And to do that, you have to do a couple of things. First, you have to identify the projects that need to be undertaken that are going to address those impairments. Then you have to do the work that actually addresses the impairments. Then what you do is you let some time go by, typically, and do some follow-up monitoring. Once you've removed all the impairments and you've got data showing that you removed all the impairments, then you delist it. You actually take it off the list, which is for us, it's just a huge victory. So the idea that since 2013, we have delisted 3 of these, whereas prior to that, we'd only delisted 1 between 1987 and 2010. We'd only had done 1. We've delisted 3 more, but just as importantly, we have finished the work at 8 others. So at the 8 other of these areas of concern, the work's been done. Now we're in the process of doing the follow-up monitoring to try to get to the point where we can say, yep, those impairments have been fully addressed. And when we do that, we'll then move to the delisting phase. Now, the St. Louis River, I'll just turn to that briefly. The St. Louis River was one of the AOCs that was originally identified. It is an enormous AOC. It's just very large in scope. There's a lot of areas where work has to be done. But we are just delighted with the amount of work that's been done in recent years. And, you know, the Howards Bay project is an example of that, where it's just another one of these areas within the AOC that, if all goes well, next spring we're going to start pulling those contaminated sediments out of there and or capping what's left behind, because you can't always get every molecule of contaminated sediment out of the AOC. So you leave it, you isolate it where it won't contribute further degradation to the environment.
You've talked about all of the work that's being done on the areas of concern and the St. Louis River. And with the Howards Bay project, what's the type of contamination that you're seeing there that needs to be cleaned up?
Well, Scott, I'm going to kick that to you because I think you know that better than I do.
Yeah, so this is Scott Sanowski. Primarily we're talking about PAHs, which is polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, and heavy metals. Primarily for the heavy metals, it is lead and mercury are the primary contamination for Howards Bay. And then the last contaminant we're looking at is tributyl tin, which was used as an anti-fouling agent for ships, but it definitely has impacts on the benthos, and it is a chemical that has been banned now for use and is no longer in use for as an anti-fouling agent.
And how is the contamination there in Howard's Bay? How has that been affecting the environment and also commerce, like with shipping?
Yeah, so in a couple of ways. So in terms of the environment, you know, the number one bioaccumulative substance, you know, that's in Howard's Bay is the mercury. So that has the potential to get into fish and wildlife and cause problems there. And there are restrictions on fish and wildlife consumptions for the St. Louis River AOC. For the heavy metals and the PAHs and the tributyl tin, one of the big impacts that they're having is that they degrade the benthic community, and the benthic community are the insects and the organisms that live in the sediments and really form the base of the food chain. It's what small fish eat. So having a degraded benthic community has the potential to degrade fish and wildlife populations, because that degradation moves up the food chain, because if the fish don't have anything to eat, then, you know, kind of the small fish don't have something to eat, the bigger fish don't have anything to eat, and then the fish-eating birds and mammals don't. So that's another one of the beneficial use impairments for the St. Louis River area of concern, is the degradation of fish and wildlife populations. And then the final way that it impacts it is, you know, around most of the area of concern for the St. Louis River, the sediments are fairly clean, and there's actually been projects that the Army Corps of Engineers and the Minnesota MPCA and the Minnesota DNR have been working on to restore habitat. And part of that restoration effort is to use clean sediments from the Corps' navigation dredging in order to create shallow water aquatic habitats around the St. Louis River estuary. In Howard's Bay, the levels of contamination there are at a point where that material needs to be confined and can't be used for in those beneficial manners. And so that contributes to another beneficial use impairment, which is the restrictions on dredging activities. So those are really the three Howard's Bay beneficial use impacts that we're trying to address with the project we're undertaking there.
So,
and Danielle, this is Chris. If I can just add, the way I like to think about this is, you know, we call these, a lot of these AOCs, legacy sites. We're dealing with a legacy of, you know, even up to 100 years or longer of disposal of materials when things were done much differently than they are today. You know, in a nutshell, the issue with contaminated sediments is it's a legacy gift, if you will, that just keeps on giving. Until you get it out of there, for all the reasons Scott just explained, you're never really going to get that area as clean as you need it to be to fully recover.
So what's the work that's going to be done then with this particular project within the St. Louis River area of concern? What's going to be done to make it cleaner for the future?
So in general, and I'll let Scott correct me if I'm wrong, but in Howard's Bay, what we're doing is we're going to be dredging sediment, removing contaminated sediment, as Scott discussed. So again, you're taking this contaminated material out of the environment in the Howard's Bay locale. You're taking it out of the environment, and you're going to put it in a landfill. You're going to isolate it so it will no longer contribute to that fish uptake and all the other impacts that Scott talked about. I mean, when we talk about sediment remediation, we talk about really one of two things. You can remove the sediment and put it somewhere safe. So, again, you isolate it. In some places, either there's so much sediment, it's not technically and or financially practicable to pull all of it out, but you can also, what we call cap, you can cap sediment, which is you can cover it with various types of layers so that the contaminant, it's isolated within the environment. You're essentially sealing it off So it won't continue to contribute to the environment. And Scott, if I'm not mistaken, is Howard's Bay a little bit of both?
Yeah, this is Scott again. So Howard's Bay is primarily a removal action, so we will be dredging the contaminated portion of the material, taking it offsite and disposing it of in a landfill. There is a small portion that will be addressed through the isolation approach, so that's a small component of it. And then also, as Chris alluded to earlier, it is very difficult in dredging to get every last molecule of contamination out of Howard's Bay or any aquatic system. And so typically at the end of a dredging project, there will be areas where that we will isolate any residual contamination, so very small masses, very thin layers of material that will receive a clean cover layer in order to prevent it from organisms from being exposed to those contaminants that are left behind.
So I'm sorry, are you saying that you're going to cap material in the bay itself, or you're going to cap material that's removed from the bay and placed elsewhere?
So, there will be a small amount of material within the bay that gets capped, but the majority of the material will be dredged and taken off-site for disposal.
And as you said before, Chris, you're hoping that this work is going to be done sometime next year. What is that contingent on, and how does funding play a role in that?
So our hope is the construction will begin next spring, the spring of 2020. A couple things have to happen now, and one of the first is we have to sign a project agreement between EPA and all the parties. The parties, I think, the Fraser Shipyards, the City of Superior, and probably another party that I'm neglecting to remember right now, I think they've already indicated or they've already signed the agreement. Now that will come to us, and we'll take a close look at it, and hopefully we'll be signing off on that agreement as well. And when we do that, we now have a partnership agreement between the three parties to make the money available to do the work. And then, again, it's going to take a little bit for, I think there still has to be some. Well, Scott, let me ask you, where are we on the design of the remediation? I assume that's not done yet?
So it is not done yet. The remedial design, which is the document that we will use to bid out for the construction services, we're at about 90% complete with that. We are addressing some comments that came back during the design review, and the goal is to complete that design by fall of this year so that we can then bid that document out for construction.
Yeah, and that explains why, and thanks, Scott. That's why we're looking at 2020, because I don't think finalizing the partnership agreement is going to be difficult at all. Again, we just need to finish the design. If they get that wrapped up in the fall, we have to let the winter roll by before we can actually get out into the field and do the construction work. That's why we're anticipating spring of 2020 to start the project. And Scott, what's the estimated length of completing the work?
We hope that it is a single construction season. Right now the schedule calls for starting in the April-May timeframe and then finishing up in the October-November timeframe of 2020.
Again, you were just listening to Chris Korleski and Scott Sanowski with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about efforts to clean up Howard's Bay in Superior. Up next, we head across the bridge to talk about work being done on the Minnesota side of the river. Barb Huberty is the Area of Concern Coordinator for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and Pat Collins is the St. Louis River Restoration Ecologist with the Minnesota DNR. The two spoke with me about cleanup and restoration projects that have been completed there and work that's coming up this summer.
The St. Louis River Area of Concern is the second largest area of concern in the entire Great Lakes Basin, and it's one of the most complex with the most diverse type of issues.
And the whole point of the area of concern is to clean up legacy contamination along the river. So what type of contamination did we see that first prompted some of the cleanup that's already been accomplished?
More broadly, the areas of concern were established because they were the ones that showed the most environmental degradation across the entire Great Lakes Basin. And the two primary areas where there were problems were the sediment contamination, but also the habitat loss, because there was so much dredging and filling when we started changing our shoreline to accommodate development. So the area of concern projects related to contamination were primarily seeing heavy metals, things like mercury, PCBs, some dioxin and furans in some places, zinc and lead in other places. But the contamination is not ubiquitous throughout the estuary. There was a contamination evaluation that was done back in 2012 that identified where the hot spots were. And then once we knew those hot spots, those later became our projects then, where we are going in and trying to figure out how do we now prevent the migration of those contaminants into the ecosystem.
And as far as cleaning up contaminated sediments goes and some of that remediation work, what's been accomplished so far in the river today?
So far in Minnesota, we've finished three slips. The Minnesota slip was finished last year, the slip 3 and slip C. And in those cases, we applied a cap above the contamination to remove that exposure pathway.
And you've been working, too, Pat, on a lot of the remediation work on the Minnesota side of the river?
Well, my role is primarily with the habitat restoration portion of the work. So I'm more involved in looking at the physical habitat loss and how we restore that for fish and wildlife, both in terms of populations of fish and wildlife and the plant communities and natural communities that support the fish and wildlife.
So with the restoration work that you've been doing, you've already made some accomplishments with restoration in Radio Tower Bay and Chambers Grove and Knowlton Creek along the river. Can you tell me a little bit more about what those projects involved?
Yeah, well, those three projects, the ones that we've completed already, have been really successful in helping to really demonstrate the progress that we can make as we're dealing with habitat restoration concerns. So Chambers Grove, what we call the Chambers Grove project site, is really a lot of work that was done in the water and along the shoreline of the Chambers Grove Park area in Duluth. So we restored fish spawning habitat by kind of changing how the river was flowing through that area. Prior to the project, a lot of the river energy was right up against the bank, up against the hardened shoreline that was there. So that hardened shoreline with the sheet piles and the rock gabions that were along the shoreline were eroding and really got damaged in the 2012 flood. So the opportunity that was presented with the cooperation with the city was to restore that shoreline to a more natural condition so that it was better for fish, better for people to connect with the river as well. And then we did a lot of work in the water and underwater to change how the river flowed to create spawning areas for walleye and for sturgeon and great places for people to fish. So it's gotten to be a pretty popular place for people to fish along the riverbank as well. You see people actually connecting to the river there. One of the other elements of the redesign was to create a carry-down canoe and kayak launch site there. So previously I'd heard stories about people that put a canoe over the railing that was there and then jumped into their canoe from, like 3 feet above the water surface. And now there's actually a spot that people can put in and paddle from Chambers Grove and really enjoy that area. There's been a human-powered paddle-the-pads fishing tournament down there a couple of years in a row now where people go down there with canoes, kayaks, paddle boats to fly fish, and it's really a great spot for both fish and for people now.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be brave enough to jump 3 feet or however far it was into a canoe, but
yeah, going just downstream a little bit from Chambers Grove, we have the Radio Tower Bay restoration site, and that was one of several sites historically that had sawmills operating for quite a long time. So from the 80s, 90s to almost 1920, there was a tremendous amount of sawmilling work that was being done on the banks of the river. And so Radiatar Bay was one of those sites that had a sawmill, or multiple sawmills actually. They milled the wood that came down from rivers and by rail from all of northeastern Minnesota, and shipped all that marketable wood off to places like, to build cities like Chicago and Detroit and things like that. All of the unmarketable stuff just got pushed into the wetland. All of the boards and pieces, the ends and the wood chips and the sawdust, but it's a lot of boards that just, you know, that stuff that wasn't marketable. And all that material remained in Radiatar Bay from the late 1800s, early 1900s, and just doesn't decompose, just overwhelms the system. So we removed over 100,000 cubic yards of wood waste from that site to deepen it, to make it more accessible for fish, to make it more accessible for anglers to get in there, just to generally improve that so that plants and animals can use the bottom of the river instead of, you know, so it's a natural bottom instead of just a bottom that's covered with boards. And that's been another success story, because now it's become a real popular place for muskie anglers to go in search of muskies that are hunting in that area now. So that's been a real success story as well.
And when did that project wrap up? Because I just remember being down there around 2015.
2015.
And just the amount of wood waste floating on top of the water.
Yeah, so the wood waste is pretty remarkable. That you think that it's been in the water for over 100 years now, and you dig it out of there and it still floats. Some of it pops up to the surface because it's just, the whole system has been overwhelmed by the volume of wood, and it hasn't gotten waterlogged to the point that it stays on the bottom if you disturb it a little bit. The Radiatar Bay project wrapped up in 2015 with the complete removal of I guess the number is 115,000 cubic yards of wood, and that was all done with a dredge barge that scooped the material out of Radiatar Bay, put it into kind of a grinder system, and pumped the slurry of wood waste and water up to the top of the hill up at the old U.S. Steel site, where we had a dewatering facility, and that wood waste is now a fine organic material. And my understanding is that the U.S. Steel folks are going to be using that material, reusing it to reclaim parts of the U.S. Steel Superfund site so that they have organic material to put on top of the sites that they're working on cleaning up on the land side.
So a lot of reuse going on.
A lot of reuse going on. And that's been really encouraging to see. So it's not just treated as waste, because that wood waste, when it's in the water, was a real problem. Once it gets up on the land, it gets dried out, it becomes a really useful product, useful organic product. And we did a lot of testing on that site. Part of the sediment characterization study that Barb talked about identified the fact that there weren't chemical contaminants of concern in that wood waste. You think about it, it's like, well, this wood waste went down, you know, 1890 to 1918. That was well before a lot of the chemical contaminants were really introduced into the system. So Knowlton Creek is one of the other habitat restoration projects that we've completed, and that's really a restoration of a trout stream. It's one of the tributary streams that feeds into the St. Louis River estuary. You know, it's the stream that really drains the Spirit Mountain watershed. So all of that snowmelt that comes down from Spirit Mountain, all of the snow that falls naturally on Spirit Mountain comes down Knowlton Creek. And It's had some pretty severe challenges in the past with land use changes, and it was really degraded, really incised deeply into the sediment that is on the hillside, and causing a lot of erosion and sediment problems downstream. So we went in there with a pretty big project to design and restore the stream banks there to remove the sediment and erosion problems so that it's not feeding additional excess sediment into the St. Louis River estuary. And it's been a real successful project to restore a pretty long stretch of a couple of reaches of Knowlton Creek, and to enable it to carry the flow that we see now in that stream.
Hey, I feel like I've seen a sign on the Munger Trail that kind of recognizes all the work that's been done on that creek.
And part of the reason that Knowlton Creek has been successful is because Spirit Mountain Authority has also been working on controlling their water and their snow melt from the ski hill. So it's been a great partnership with the City of Duluth and the Spirit Mountain Authority and the DNR and all of the other restoration partners to address that whole issue of how we've changed the watershed, what that means for what has to happen with moving water in that stream corridor. So now the stream is able to handle the volume of water that's coming off that hillside in a way that it wasn't prior to the project.
Pat had mentioned two other restoration projects that were close to finishing, and those are the 21st Avenue West project and the 40th Avenue West project. And you can imagine back when this area was being developed for shipping, there was a lot of dredging that happened. So the areas here became deeper than was natural. And so what we're trying to restore here are what we call shallow sheltered bays. And by utilizing the material that the Corps routinely dredges out of its navigation channels, we can create underwater features that shallow up the bay to provide more protection for both plants and bottom of the food chain animals, and then it becomes a better place for fish to come and utilize as well. So you can think about all of our projects as really trying to improve the health of the bottom of the food chain, and by doing that, then we also are helping the other animals higher up the food chain.
It has a ripple effect throughout the food web. Okay.
So we're creating underwater features that the underwater features that were built with the dredge materials are completed here. We'll be completing them this year. We also have the opportunity to take what we call biomedia from other sites that have work done on them to inoculate that bottom of the food web with the benthic critters that live there as well as the plants. So this one will be left open so that we can accept that biomedium. And then specifically at 40th, some of the biomedium that's removed from the forthcoming Kingsbury Bay project is going to be moved and applied on top of those features here.
So when we talk about biomedium, it's really mud with stuff in it. And the stuff is the living creatures and the living plants and seeds and things like that. So what we're planning to do with some of the material from Kingsbury Bay, it's clean mud. So when we talk about clean mud, it's like it doesn't have chemicals of concern in it that we have to treat differently. So this is stuff that is free of chemicals of concern, but it has seeds in it. It has plant roots. It has little bugs in there that live in the bottom of the river. And we're going to be moving some of that from where there's been excess deposits of sediment, like Kingsbury Bay, move it over to these sites at like 40th Avenue West, where it's pretty much bare inorganic sand right now from the dredge material deposits, and put that on top of it so that it has a source of plants and animals that can really start to populate those sites.
Like the chocolate on a chocolate dipped cone. We're just topping it so that all the good stuff can grow.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to just point out is that one of the challenges that we have with doing some of these habitat restoration projects and the sediment remediation projects is that a lot of the real work is happening underwater, and we don't necessarily see the change. If you're looking out at the surface of the water, the surface doesn't look like it's changed all that much. But really what we're trying to do is have a big impact on those key components that right at the bottom of the river, where all of the life happens, all of the biological productivity is happening at the bottom of the river. And we're trying to fix that part of the system.
So is that why you're doing the restoration then in Kingsbury Bay?
So the restoration in Kingsbury Bay is really looking at that bottom of the river, trying to address the fact that there's been a lot of excess sediment that's been deposited in Kingsbury Bay, and it's built up over time. And some of that is coming down from Kingsbury Creek. Some of it has happened because of the big flood events that we've had recently and big erosion events that have happened with culverts and causeways blowing out and dumping that into Kingsbury Bay. What we're trying to do is remove that, reuse it in places that it's really beneficial. So like 40th Avenue West, we're also going to be reusing that material at Grassy Point. So the project that we have coming up this summer, we're calling the Kingsbury Bay / Grassy Point project because they're so intimately tied together. we're taking material out of Kingsbury Bay and reusing it in Grassy Point to restore some of the features that have been lost there due to erosion or dredging and filling of places and dealing with the wood waste. So Grassy Point is another place that had a long history of sawmill operations. There's actually still some old pilings and foundations of sawmills that existed out there until the Cloquet Fire of 1918 burned through and burned everything down that was there. That was sort of the end of the logging or the sawmilling activity in a lot of places in the western part of Duluth. But we'll be removing wood waste that's in Grassy Point and rebuilding some features that have been then lost out there, and then adding some of the material from Kingsbury Bay on top of that, again, to really restore the biological activity at the surface so that we can get the plant communities back, get the benthic invertebrate communities back, get the fish food back in the system and the bird food back in the system.
So are you hoping that people will be able to use it more once you do all of that, or is it just for more for the health of the system itself?
A lot of what we're doing is really trying to address the root of the problems, the core problems with the health of the system. But that has some really important ancillary benefits or secondary benefits for human communities, and we're trying to take those into consideration as we're doing designs. So, for example, like with Radio Tower Bay, we're removing the wood waste so that it's better for fish and wildlife populations, better for the native plant communities, but it also makes it better for anglers because the fish like it, the anglers come to find the fish, and it makes it more accessible as well. It's going to be similar with Kingsbury Bay and Grassy Point. It's going to be great fish and wildlife habitat, but that will also make it really good habitat for people to recreate and to enjoy being able to just getting down to the river and seeing a healthy system.
Again, you were just listening to Barb Huberty with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Pat Collins with the Minnesota DNR. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio, and up next we take a look back on some of the news of the week. Wisconsin lawmakers are weighing in on whether Attorney General William Barr should release the full report from Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Wisconsin Democrats are pushing for a full release of the special prosecutor's findings. Republican Congressman Sean Duffy told CNN this week that the AG's summary shows there was no collusion between President Trump's campaign and Russia. He says Democrats and the media should move on.
What we can do now is say, let's report on all the good news, that unemployment is down, that salaries are up, that we've crushed ISIS, that we have American energy independence. There's going to be far more time for the networks around America to report on the great news that are making Americans' lives better.
Democrats argue Congress should be able to weigh in on whether the president committed any impeachable offenses. Democratic Governor Tony Evers has given jobs back to most of former Governor Scott Walker's appointees he essentially fired last week, but is leaving some key positions open. Republican senators confirmed 82 Walker appointees during a December lame duck session. A Dane County judge ruled last week that the session was illegal, but an appeals court stayed the ruling Wednesday. During the interim, Evers rescinded all the Walker appointments. A bipartisan group of legislators are preparing to introduce a bill that would delay closing Wisconsin's troubled youth prison by 6 months. Former Governor Scott Walker signed a bill last year that closes the prison near Irma by 2021 and moving the inmates to county or state-run facilities. Jake Patterson pled guilty this week to 2 counts of homicide and 1 count of kidnapping for abducting barren teen Jamie Kloss and killing her parents in October. Rich Kramer has that story.
In a plea deal with the Barron County District Attorney's Office, Patterson pled guilty to killing James and Denise Kloss and kidnapping Jamie on October 15th. Patterson teared up and paused to compose himself when the judge asked him how he would respond to the charge of kidnapping Jamie.
How do you plead to that charge?
Take your time. Take a deep breath. One deep breath. Guilty.
Patterson faces up to 2 life sentences for killing Jamie's parents and 40 years for the kidnapping. Patterson kept Jamie at his home in Gordon for 3 months before she escaped. The Douglas County District Attorney's Office won't file charges related to the time he held her captive. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Superior City Council agreed to pursue a lawsuit against opioid manufacturers and distributors this week. As Olivia Shalaby reports, the city joins Duluth in retaining counsel to pursue the suit.
The city will be hiring Keller Lenkner, an outside law firm from Chicago, to represent them in the lawsuit. The Center for Disease Control reports on average 130 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. Seth Meyer is an attorney with Keller Lenkner. He says many different cities and counties are pursuing similar lawsuits.
Essentially, manufacturers manipulated approved medical practice for their opioid drugs over a period of years that led to the current epidemic that we see, and that essentially that distributors flagrantly violated their obligations under state and federal law to move their Schedule II products over from facility to facility.
Brent Fennessy is Superior City Council Vice President. He says this lawsuit could be a step towards fighting the opioid epidemic in the city.
One thing, there's the money side of things to give us some relief to put towards some different programs like the Pathway to Hope and to try and solve this epidemic. The other part of this lawsuit that I think is more important is the injunctive relief, where they're going to look at the chain and to try and break that chain and to put some regulation in there to break the chain to stop this from happening again for future generations.
Superior Mayor Jim Payne says Superior is a victim to the opioid epidemic.
It's been affected in many different ways. Many of them, I'm not sure we could count. We've lost human lives to this. It has cost us tremendous amounts of money, both to the city itself as well as to the victims of crimes committed to finance this addiction. It's ruined families.
Both Payne and Fennessy say if the city wins, they plan to put the money into a program that helps people recover from addiction. This week, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call also announced that he's joining a multi-state investigation into marketing and sales practices of opioid distributors. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that's a look back on some of the news of the week, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.